From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, three acts marked as political violence in the U.S. in the last 8 days. Any thread? And later, artificial intelligence in colleges where students like this Duke sophomore says at least AI is always available.
I have jobs. I have other classes. I have clubs. I don't have the time always to like be able to make all these office hours. It's nice to have something on my own time able to respond to me the same way that maybe a person would.
But does it really? And later, the World Baseball Classic. Team Italy bubbles like Mount Vesuvius and James Blake's new album, Trying Times. First, we have our newscast. It's Saturday, March 14, 2026.
KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A judge has denied a motion to dismiss charges filed last year against a correctional nursing director following the death of a man in Beltrami County jail custody. Chelsea Perkins brings us the update.
27-year-old Hardell Sherrell died in September 2018, 2 days after serious symptoms resulted in a hospital visit. The doctor who discharged him wrote instructions listing several symptoms that should have prompted Sherrell to seek additional immediate care. Instead, according to the criminal complaint, Sherrell received very little care and his health rapidly deteriorated. Michelle Scroke was the nurse in charge at the Beltrami County Jail when Sherrell died. Scroke was also the director of nursing for Mend Correctional Care. She was responsible for reviewing and approving the company's care policies and overseeing all its nurses across multiple jails. The 38-year-old faces three felonies for manslaughter and criminal neglect. Scroke's defense sought dismissal, arguing that her conduct did not deviate from the lawfully permissible standard. In a denial order filed Thursday, Beltrami County Judge Janine Brand says the state attorney general's office showed sufficient probable cause to allow the case to move forward. Prosecutors submitted more than 3,000 pages of documents and 2 hours of video footage. Brand writes that despite knowing Sherrell was just in the hospital, Scroke never took his vitals, ignored him for hours at a time, and yelled at him that he was, quote, faking it. When Scroke left the day Sherrell died, evidence shows she knew he had lost control of his bladder, his face was drooping, he had difficulty swallowing, couldn't stand, and was becoming weaker. His cause of death was pneumonia and brain swelling, likely complications of the autoimmune disease Guillain-Barré syndrome. A plea hearing in the case is set for 10 a.m. on Monday. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
Representative Pete Stauber is proposing legislation aimed at preventing fraud in child care assistance programs. The Republican introduced the bill Thursday, which he called the Stop Fraud by Somalia Act. A bill with the same name was introduced by Senate Republicans in January. Stauber says widespread child care fraud in Minnesota was primarily perpetrated by Somalis. In a news release touting the legislation, Stauber says the bill would bar people convicted of fraud from the Child Care Assistance Program for life, require states to reimburse the federal government for fraudulently obtained funds, and allow non-citizens to be deported for committing fraud. The Council on American Islamic Relations Minnesota condemned the legislation, calling the bill's name and framing discriminatory and deeply irresponsible. The organization says the rhetoric contributes to harmful stereotypes and that fraud is a crime by individuals, not an entire community. The whirlwind of fraud concerns in Minnesota has been primarily driven by providers billing for services that weren't provided. The fraud was enabled by a long-documented lack of oversight in the state's largely federally funded Department of Human Services programs, including child care assistance. Stauber invited right-wing influencer Nick Shirley to the State of the Union last month. A video by Shirley went viral in December and brought national attention to Minnesota. In it, he visited 10 Minneapolis daycares run by Somali residents that he said were not caring for children and were misappropriating funds. The Minnesota Star Tribune found children inside four of the daycares and had previously reported on issues with the assistance program. Many northern Minnesota school boards could soon be a little smaller. A new bill in the state legislature would allow districts with fewer than 1,000 students to switch to a 5-member board with voter approval. Roughly 70% of rural northern Minnesota school districts would be eligible for the reduction. Under state law, school boards must have 6 members unless voters approve adding a 7th.
This structure does not reflect the realities facing Minnesota's smallest districts, particularly in rural areas where they may not have enough candidates to fill all 6 seats.
DFL Senator Grant Hochschild of Hermantown presented the bill to the Education Policy Committee Monday. Many school board races are uncontested, and sometimes no one runs at all. When that happens, the school board has to appoint someone to fill the vacancy.
In fact, our current board chair in Cook County was appointed and then ran for re-election and is still there.
Cook County Superintendent Chris Lindholm testified in support of the bill. The committee laid the bill over for inclusion in an omnibus package. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The war the U.S. and Israel are waging on Iran is entering its third week. We have heard several versions of what President Trump would consider to be victory. What about Israel? We're joined now by Chuck Freilich. He served as Israel's Deputy National Security Advisor and now teaches at both Columbia and Tel Aviv University. Mr. Freilich, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Just how aligned are the U.S. and Israel strategically? Do they have the same vision of victory?
Well, I think the war started with essentially a complete confluence of objectives. And first and foremost, there was a hope that the war would lead to regime change. And of course, this is sort of a minimum objective, significantly degrading Iran's nuclear and missile capabilities and further weakening its ability to protect its influence around the region to support the proxies.
Well,
there's some...
Please go ahead, sir.
No, I think there's some difference today, certainly on the emphasis on the regime change aspect. Israel would... I think is more committed to that objective than the U.S. But in the end, this will come down to what the president decides. And I believe that Israel will go along with it.
A new NPR PBS News Marist poll finds the majority of Americans surveyed are against the war. What's the feeling in Israel?
Well, for Israel, it's very different. For Israel, this is an existential war, which has been in the making for some decades. And so you see basically across the board support in Israel from left to right. There's shared support for all of the objectives that I mentioned before. That support, I believe, will stay there for as long as people believe that there is a credible possibility of a successful outcome. If that changes, we'll see support diminish.
Well, would that raise the possibility that the U.S. might want to call an end to actions against Iran at a time Israel would like to continue them because they're short of their goals?
Yes, that's true. And again, for the U.S., I believe this is a major foreign policy issue, but it is certainly not existential. And for Israel, it is. So there can be a difference in that situation.
You have examined Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza and criticized the lack of a plan afterwards. Do you believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his government has a plan on the boards for a post-war Iran?
Well, I think there was significant. First of all, the military operation itself, I think, has been nothing short of brilliant so far. And we've seen both countries, and especially Israel, trying to methodically destroy the instruments of regime suppression. So attacking the Revolutionary Guards, the besieged police stations throughout the country, trying to create an opening for the people to come back out on the streets. Whether there is a strategy beyond that is questionable.
Well, what do you make of, for example, the massive demonstration that the world saw yesterday in Tehran, the government, of course.
Right. We know that something like 20% of the Iranian public does still support the regime, and the remainder do not want various shades of change. But unsurprisingly, the regime rallied that percentage of the public that does support it to put on a big show. We couldn't expect anything else.
If you were advising the Israeli government right now, what might you advise them, taking into account regional insecurity, new supreme leader, what's happening to the global oil market as a result of the war?
Well, I think that if one resorts to military force, and that's most certainly not always the appropriate way to go, but if you do so, you have to play to win, and or just declare victory at some point, decide that you've achieved sufficient objectives. But if that's not the case, and I think there is still a basis for trying to play to win, the U.S. and Israel have to decide to up the ante and escalate in the next few days. I think we saw a first indication of that last night with the attack on Karaj Island, but that was just on the island's defenses, I understand, not on the actual oil infrastructure. I mean, at the moment, there's a unacceptable situation in which Iran has closed the Straits of Hormuz to international shipping, but Iranian oil exports are continuing through the Straits and have even increased. So the first thing that has to be done is that the Straits have to be closed off to Iran or opened again for everyone.
I'm afraid we're out of time, Mr. Freilich.
Okay.
Former Israeli Deputy National Security Advisor Chuck Freilich, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Three separate attacks in the U.S. since last Saturday have been marked as political violence, and two are being investigated as acts of terrorism. NPR's domestic extremism correspondent Odette Yosef joins us now to sort through an attack on a synagogue in a Detroit suburb, an attempted attack on anti-Muslim protesters in New York, and a shooting at a university in Virginia. Odette, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott.
What is the latest we know about all these attacks?
Well, the synagogue attack in Michigan involved a naturalized Lebanese-American citizen who NPR has learned lost two brothers last week to an Israeli strike in Lebanon, and his parents and sisters-in-law were also wounded. Security at the synagogue shot and killed him. Nobody else died in that incident. Earlier on that same day, a gunman shot and killed someone at Old Dominion University in Virginia. He also died at the scene. There is still more to learn about this person, Scott, but he did serve time in prison after pleading guilty about a decade ago to providing material support for ISIS, the Islamic State. And then last weekend, there was an attempted attack on Islamophobic protesters outside the mayor's mansion in New York City. An 18-year-old and a 19-year-old have been charged, and they allegedly made statements effectively saying that they were inspired by ISIS.
Obviously, it can be tempting to tie these attacks together. Is that called for? Is it premature?
I think it's important to look at each individual instance. It certainly feels like the war on Iran is elevating uncertainty here. In the case of the attempted attack outside Gracie Mansion in New York, though, there's no indication that it ties directly to grievance about the war. In the case of the Old Dominion attack, we simply don't know enough right now to say. And in the attack on Temple Israel outside of Detroit, officials have not stated a motive. I think what we can absolutely say is that the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran has provided a new opening that foreign terrorist groups are exploiting. Here's Michael Masters. He's national director of the Secure Community Network, which does threat monitoring and security training for the Jewish community across North America.
We have seen the calls for violence coming from Iran, coming from its proxies. We have seen the calls for violence coming from other designated terrorist organizations, from the so-called Islamic State to Al-Qaeda and others. We know that people are working to answer that call and that they are answering it at quicker pace.
Answering it at a quicker pace sounds alarming.
Yes, and this is something that extremism researchers have been observing now for some time, Scott, that people are indoctrinating into extremist ideologies faster than had ever really been the case before. A big part of that has been technology. Social media companies have largely pulled back on content moderation. And this means that we're seeing an increase in dehumanizing content, threats, and extremist propaganda on mainstream platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Here's Bill Braniff. He's with the Polarization and Extremism Research Lab at American University.
The internet is becoming a more and more dangerous place, and AI is accelerating that trend as resources are being pulled back from not just content moderation, but all the different ways one can make a platform a safer place.
Odette, what are people in faith communities asking for?
Most immediately, Scott, I'm hearing calls for more federal funding for physical security and training. They are asking for roughly three times what is currently provided in federal grants. But I will be frank, the people I've been speaking to are not seeing this problem getting better anytime soon. We don't have a clear idea of how long the fighting in Iran will go. And ultimately, what Braniff and others say we need is to shift to a prevention model that can address some of the underlying reasons that people may go looking for extreme ideas or communities online.
Odette Yosef, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Later today on All Things Considered, the Paramount Skydance deal to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery will merge two major film studios and also put two news outlets, CBS and CNN, under the same ownership. A former antitrust regulator and historian of the communications industry has some warnings.
We're in an age of interested billionaires using media outlets to very straightforwardly promote the messages that they believe in, who have not even a pretense of neutrality.
There's more this afternoon. You can ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. And you're listening to NPR News.
Pam Perry from Brainerd is a regular contributor to the KAXE Morning Show. She talks about birds and other wildlife. We asked her why she supports this station.
So, and now the most recent thing is the newsroom. And I love the news reports. You're not hearing that anywhere else. You're not hearing about what county boards are doing and local governments. This is the place. This is where you're going to hear about it. And the music was wonderful. And you had your volunteer hosts. And again, local people often. I want to support it. I want to support something. And then, of course, when I was listening, I was going, where else do you hear about bud break and plants and birds and forestry and all the things that, we're Northern Minnesota.
You can become a member like Pam Perry. Give now at KAXE.org. It's 19 minutes after 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. 9 o'clock, it's the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Julie Crabb, and Heather Johnson talking about this year's award-nominated movies. The Oscars are tomorrow night. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. At noon, the history of recorded jazz with Paul Kivi. Support for KAXE comes from Lakeland PBS, offering 24/7 PBS Kids programming, the PBS Kids video app, educational resources for teachers, parents, and more at lptv.org. The Buck Lake Community Center, located 12 miles north of Nashwauk, has a bingo party today. Doors will open at 12:30. Games start at 1 o'clock. They'll have food available for purchase plus raffles. Find more details on the Buck Lake Improvement Club's Facebook page. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. President Trump's cabinet features more than a couple former rivals for the presidency, but just one from his own party, Marco Rubio. A senator from Florida, Marco Rubio supported a stable world order and human rights. He advocated for aid to be deployed as American soft power. As Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, he now serves a president who campaigned on leaving the world to its own devices, but who in office has upended global stability. Just this year, and remember, it is only March, the United States raided the capital of Venezuela and captured that country's leader and launched an ongoing attack on Iran. President Trump says that Cuba, where Rubio has family roots, could be next. Dexter Filkins profiled Marco Rubio for The New Yorker, and he joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
10 years ago, Donald Trump and Marco Rubio were antagonists on the debate stage. How did Marco Rubio become his Secretary of State?
Well, you know, Trump has a history of forgiving people who have insulted him. And even during the campaign in 2016, when they went behind the stage, they chatted a lot and they became kind of friends. And so in that way, I think they both realized that politics is a game, and a lot of it is performance, and they kind of set that aside when the cameras are off.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of U.S. senator was he? He arrived just as the Tea Party was gaining power, criticized President Obama, but then, of course, he worked towards things like immigration reform.
He did. I mean, he has an interesting past, a political past. It's difficult to track because he moves around so much. Rubio, if you look at the course of his career, he said different things on different occasions, and it's basically whatever suits the occasion.
But I should note that's the most common criticism you hear of politicians of both parties.
Well, I think Rubio has a special, he's in a special category on that front. But as a U.S. Senator, Marco Rubio relentlessly advocated for a very active role for America abroad as the leader of the free world, as a donor of foreign aid, as a country that was willing to intervene, sometimes militarily if necessary. And so when he paired with Trump, the curiosity was, is Rubio going to have to lose all that? Because President Trump campaigned on America first, getting America out of all these stupid alliances that we're in, and not starting any wars. What's happened, of course, is entirely the opposite.
What brought Donald Trump over to Marco Rubio's way of thinking? Forgive me for putting it this way. Was he played?
Not a chance. Not a chance that he was played. But I think President Trump is an activist president. He involves himself in everything. And I think Iran has been a problem for every American president going all the way back to Jimmy Carter. And so it's not that surprising to me that Trump, once engaged in Iran, would try to settle it. I am surprised that we got back into it in the way that we did. If you remember, there was no speech to the nation. There was no congressional vote. Trump posted something on, you know, Twitter or Truth Social at 2:30 in the morning. Marco Rubio said, I think what still remains a very curious thing when he was asked about why we attacked Iran when we did. And he said, well, the Israelis were going to do it, whether we went or not. And so if the Israelis did it, then we figured the Iranians would probably attack our bases in the Middle East. So we jumped in. And he backed away from that, you know, 100 miles an hour after he said it. But I think if anybody played President Trump, it's not Marco Rubio, but it's Netanyahu in Israel.
And I have to ask about Cuba, because, of course, Secretary Rubio has a, yeah, I can say it, a personal relationship.
He does indeed. The prospect of bringing that regime down, that's the dream for, like, every elected official in Miami, is to be, and Marco Rubio is now in the catbird seat and might be in a position to do something about that. I wouldn't predict the future here, because if we look at the Iran war, I think it's not going the way that they expected it to go. And so, you know, I would probably hit the pause button on Cuba, at least until there's some kind of outcome.
Do you think Secretary Rubio is running for president?
I think he wants to be president. he ran for president. It's probably a race between Marco Rubio on one hand and J.D. Vance, the vice president, on the other. One of the questions that caroms around Washington all the time is, like, who's Trump going to pick? You know, who does Trump want? Is he closer to J.D. or is he closer to Marco? And, you know, all this is kind of playing out as we speak. But we've got a long way to go before we get to 2028.
Dexter Filkins is staff writer for The New Yorker, who has profiled Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
A lot of college students are using artificial intelligence to do schoolwork. A survey of students by Inside Higher Ed and Generation Lab found 85% did just that during the last school year. And as Lee Gaines reports, professors and students are still contending with what this technology might mean for learning.
Dan Cryer teaches English at Johnson County Community College outside Kansas City. He says using AI to write a college essay is like bringing a forklift to the gym.
If all we needed was the weights moved, then that would be great. But we need the muscles developed. And students going through the process of writing are developing those muscles. And that's the important thing.
Cryer explains to his students that the world doesn't need more college essays.
What we need is students to go through the process of writing research papers so that they can become better thinkers, so that they can put together a cogent argument, so they can differentiate between a good source and a bad source.
If students rely too much on AI, Cryer says it could end up cheating them out of the education they signed up for. He doesn't see much value in the technology for humanities courses. But not everyone agrees. Across higher ed, there's no consensus over whether or how to incorporate this new technology. In Charlotte, North Carolina, Professor Leslie Clement says AI is a central part of her lessons.
We encourage them to use it because we know they're going to use it, but to use it in a responsible way.
She teaches English, Spanish, and African studies at the historically Black Johnson C. Smith University. She has her students use AI for all kinds of tasks.
So to create the outlines for their papers, to put in their ideas, ask them to maybe compare or get two different types of sources.
Clement says her goal is to ensure her students use these tools in ways that benefit humanity.
I want students not only to use the tools for good, but also to interrogate them. And how are they producing harm in our communities, and how can we use them in the future for good?
Students are also navigating how or if to use AI. Anjali Tatini is a 19-year-old sophomore at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. She says AI has deepened her learning. Take last semester, when Tatini was studying some pretty confusing biology concepts.
And I would use Google Gemini to help me, like, break down these concepts. So I'd be like, this is the concept, can you explain what it means? And I would have questions about it. And I would ask those questions to the AI, and it would just respond to me. And if it was too high level, I could ask it to, like, dumb it down a little bit, which was very helpful.
Tatini says some of her professors encourage students to use AI in this manner. And she says it's helpful to have a tutor on demand because she's not always able to meet with her professors in person.
I have jobs. I have other classes. I have clubs. I don't have the time always to, like, be able to make all these office hours. So it's nice to have something that's on my own time, able to respond to me the same way that maybe a person would.
To be clear, Tatini says she would never use generative AI to write something for her. But she says it's a really helpful tool. Nearby in Chapel Hill, college student Hannah Elder says she uses AI sparingly.
I'm such a strong believer in cultivating your own thoughts and being able to articulate them.
Elder is a 21-year-old junior at the University of North Carolina. She takes philosophy courses and sometimes uses AI to proofread her work. She says in the humanities, the whole point is to form your own argument. And if students lean on AI to do that for them, she worries they won't learn to think for themselves.
I use notebook paper still in all my notes because I just believe so strongly in like what you write down and what you produce is like a fingerprint to the world. And I think in some sense that's being lost.
Still, Elder doesn't think the solution is to ban AI entirely. She says universities need to integrate it into the curriculum so students learn to see the line between helpful and harmful. For NPR News, I'm Lee Gaines.
Oh, it's time for sports. World Baseball Classic quarterfinals, and Italy is perking. Selection Sunday for March Madness. Sports reporter Michelle Steele joins us. Michelle, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here, Scott.
The U.S. beat Canada 5-3, World Baseball Classic last night, moves on to the semifinals. Dominican Republic is next. This is a U.S. team led by Aaron Judge, Cal Raleigh, Bryce Harper, but they haven't exactly cleaned up so far, have they?
No, they haven't. But let me just say that Cal Raleigh, the big dumper, is my favorite nickname in baseball, Scott. That voluminous posterior.
And it means a lot to him, too. But yeah.
All sides of him. But you know what? You're right. The World Baseball Classic has this funny way of humbling even the most stacked lineups like the United States. They've looked a little uneven, just a few too many runners left on base, a few too many moments where you're thinking, come on, guys. But they did get the job done against Canada. They're through to the semis, and we have an amazing matchup with the DR on deck. It'll be Paul Skenes getting the start against the Dominican Republic's Platino Power, Scott. But they need to bring it here. They need to bring their A game because they don't want another upset like the 8-6 loss to Italy we saw this week.
Speaking of which, Italy, late this afternoon, faces Puerto Rico for a spot in the semifinals. When the ball hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's Italia. When another run scores, the espresso is poured for Team Italia.
That needs to be your ringtone, Scott.
Oh, is that possible? I'll ask our daughters. Listen, a well-caffeinated team with the espresso machine in the dugout, if people didn't know, how do you see their chances of advancing?
Gosh, they have been the feel-good story of this entire tournament. They're having so much fun out there. They're loose, and guess what? They're undefeated. Maybe that espresso machine isn't a joke. As a power coffee drinker, I respect it deeply. But Puerto Rico is no pushover. They got plenty of talent. But honestly, don't count out Italy. Something magical is happening over there right now.
Absolutely. Listen, NCAA basketball tournament begins Tuesday, tomorrow selection Sunday. Clear-cut top three with Duke, Arizona, and Michigan. What are the teams you have your eye on?
Yeah, the team I keep coming back to is San Diego State. They just won a massive game last night in Las Vegas against New Mexico. They may actually need to win their conference tournament today to truly feel safe. VCU out of Richmond, really impressive all season, but they've only beaten two top-tier opponents. Committee's going to really look at that. And then there's a storyline that, Scott, I just can't stop thinking about. Auburn, the Tigers have 16 losses. No team has ever gotten an at-large bid with that many losses ever. But their schedule has been really brutal. The bubble is really weak this year, so they might just pull it off. I'm going to be locked in on Selection Sunday tomorrow.
FIFA World Cup begins in the U.S. in 3 months. This week, President Trump said Iran's team is welcome to come, but, quote, I really don't believe it is appropriate that they be there for their own life and safety. Isn't the World Cup supposed to promote sportsmanship across political divisions?
That's kind of the whole point of it, right? I've watched every World Cup for as long as I can remember. I cannot think of a single time where the president of a host nation has publicly questioned whether a qualified team should even show up. That just doesn't happen. The host country's job is to welcome the world. That's the whole deal. You put on the tournament, you open the doors, you let the sport do what the sport is supposed to do, bring people together across the divides that politics creates. And honestly, as a sports fan, it's a little exhausting to see all this.
Our sports expert, Michelle Steele. Michelle, thanks so much for speaking with you. Talk to you again soon.
You bet, Scott.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Four Saturdays a month, we can tell you that BJ Lederman does our theme music, but once a month, above a restaurant in suburban New Jersey, you can find a dance party. It's for people who want the feeling of a big night out, but also need to get up in the morning. Buffy Gorilla went to meet the mostly millennial movers and shakers.
The oversized disco ball hanging above the large wooden dance floor is doing what it does best, casting glimmering light over middle-aged partiers and giving off high school dance vibes.
Well, when my friend posed it as old ladies dancing, I had to go.
Suzanne Wang is not old. She is 47. And when her group chat started blowing up with details about a mom's night out, Wang, a mother of two, was a firm yes.
This absolutely meets the need of everyone who wants to go out, have a good time, hear some good music, and also be home by a reasonable hour.
That's the idea behind All My Friends, a monthly low-stress dance party hosted by Elizabeth Spiridakis and a group of her dance party-loving friends.
We like kind of joke and say it's like the exennial dance party of your dreams. The vibes are immaculate, as they say.
Doors open at 7 p.m. Some nights up to 300 people spill onto the dance floor. It's mostly groups of friends coming for a fun night out. But there are some serious dance couples like Donna Domino and Joseph Smith. They drop their coats, glide across the room, and start moving to Holiday by Madonna.
It's just a lot of fun, especially getting here early, have the whole dance floor to yourself. And music is good, and people just here to have a good time.
That's thanks to DJ Preston Olson, a.k.a. Dirty Preston. He stands in his booth ready to respond to requests for hits from the early aughts.
It's like kind of feeling out the crowd and what they're really liking. And then sometimes them like kind of understanding that they like this kind of music and then being like, well, oh, wait, I think they maybe some of them have not heard this, but they might like this in the same vein and not understand that they do.
But Ed Sheeran is banned from his sets. That's fine with All My Friends regular Amanda Harris. Her jam is
anything Bad Bunny.
Harris dances like no one is watching, in comfortable shoes.
There's no expectation, so it's less about like how I look to other people. I think it's just the assurance that comes when you're older. I think we all have just like such real things going on. Like many of us have families, we have kids, we have jobs. And then obviously just the outside surrounding world is a little chaotic right now. So I think it just creates this really safe space to come and let loose and just have fun.
The rest of the world can wait until at least 11 p.m. Theodora Lopez says she and her family have a full day of activities tomorrow.
Basketball at 1, another basketball at 4, and then dinner plans.
Same story for her wing woman, Suzanne Wang.
We've got a number of different activities tomorrow that culminates in my daughter's 16th birthday.
She'll get to bed early tonight, but for now, there's time for one more dance. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla in Montclair, New Jersey.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:39. You're listening to KAXC and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. 9 o'clock, it's the Oscar Breakdown with Heather Johnson, Andrew DeZingle, and Julie Crabb. And 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel on Back Porch Harmony. Programming is supported by The Forge in Grand Rapids, offering a space where students, entrepreneurs, and workers can bring their ideas to evolve into products, careers, or businesses, building a culture of innovation and diversity in the heart of Itasca County. Learn more at theforgeitasca.org, where ideas take shape. You can get a head start on spring cleaning with KAXC's CARS program. Your unwanted vehicle will be towed away and the proceeds fuel all your favorite programs. It's quick, easy, and there's no cost to you. Visit kaxc.org/cars to get started. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition on KAXC.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXC KBXC.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, they listen to this, Green Cheese, and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it, so it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local, and given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at kaxc.org.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia. For 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The narrator of Luc Kennard's new novel is never named. He just declares, "I'm an actor," though mostly unemployed and painfully poor, until a university professor, Dr. Blend, offers him a role, the starring role, in fact, in an experiment. Zip himself into a black leather bag and sit in the back of his class.
I am in black bag, and I'm lying on a desk at the back of the lecture theatre. From the feel of it, I imagine it to be a desk with metal legs painted a glossy grey, and the surface to be a pine-coloured fake wood veneer. But why shouldn't I imagine the room to be far nicer than it may, in fact, be?
His new novel, Black Bag, and Luc Kennard joins us now from our studios in London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
And I gather this is, at least in part, inspired by an actual black bag experiment in 1967?
That's right. At the University of Oregon, and a professor called Charles Gertzinger, who was using it to test the mere exposure effect, the idea that we become fond of things just by encountering them over and over again, even if we dislike them at first. The experiment ran for a whole term, and the students at first disliked Black Bag and found his presence in the classroom abject and unsettling. But then they came to quite like him over the weeks, and they ended up standing up for him if anyone criticized his appearance or his silence. And by the end of the semester, they were sort of inviting him out for the kind of end of term party. Even though he never said a thing, he never responded when he was spoken to. They'd come to love him on some level.
What does Dr. Blend, the professor at the unnamed university in your novel, hope the man in the black bag may call forth or bring out?
He's towards the end of his career, and I think he's trying not to be jaded. He's trying to still believe in the reason he first went into education, the sort of passion for his subject and sharing it with impressionable young people. And he's become obsessed with this particular experiment, and he's reiterated it. We sort of find out over the course of the novel, this is like the 25th time that he's done it, but it always goes wrong in some terrible way. So this is the last time he's running the experiment and hopes that this might be the perfect appointee to the role.
But don't actors want to play roles that express more than just sitting inside a black bag? Or is that the challenge?
I think partly that's the challenge. I think also the narrator is so disappointed. So he's 37 and he's been trying to be an actor for most of his adult life, and all he can get is sort of murder mystery dinner theatre, which he sort of hates, or sort of experimental issues-based theatre, which he hates even more. And it's, he's quite a sort of theatre snob in a way, and he would rather be in Ibsen or Chekhov, and just, but none of those roles are available to him. So in a way, I think it's almost him as a kind of act of protest against his own ambitions, in a way. To be Black Bag is to kind of just try to remove himself from the equation in some way and just play a non-role, a non-self.
There's an attraction that develops with an accomplished professor named Justine. Should I call it a love story?
Yeah, no, I think so.
What does she find compelling about the man in the black bag? Well, about the black bag. She doesn't really know it's a man for a while.
Yeah. And she's a professor of posthumanism, which I sort of read up just enough about to be able to give her some insights into it. But she is fascinated by, I suppose, this idea of erasure, but particularly as it relates to masculinity. So she talks about some of her consultancy work that she does outside of lecturing in the tech industry, with a lot of troubled or sort of toxic young men who are making terrible decisions, and that she's paid to try and sort them out in some way. And I think she sees Black Bag as a potential therapeutic method of making them more conscientious, or just making them more aware, or even just sort of, you know, silencing them for a little bit, putting them in a bag for a bit.
She says at one point, I think it's about masculinity, right?
Totally, that's it for her. And I think because it is a sort of a slightly haunting, silent figure or sort of imago, right? So everyone projects their own desires or professional needs or interpretations onto him, and the narrator is sort of passive enough to just let that happen, or is uncertain enough to be like, well, maybe that is it. Maybe I can go along with this.
I find myself thinking, we often regard people as black bags, don't we? Filling in the blanks for suppositions we make without really knowing.
Right. I think that's it at the core, right? That it's that level of subjectivity which almost needs to be a constant reminder to ourselves that everybody is inwardly as confused, as occasionally brilliant, as awful, as conflicted as we are, I think. And I think there's always that risk of other people being reduced to flatter characters for us. And I think for him, it's in the context of his professional, creative, and romantic kind of frustrations or feelings of inadequacy. But I think, again, I think that's sort of universal.
I have to ask, you teach creative writing at the University of Birmingham.
Yeah.
I did mark some other words you wrote from Dr. Blend. We're supposedly the finest minds in our respective disciplines, but we're required to spend most of our time boring, hungover teenagers to sleep.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, I should add that my own students are brilliant and surprisingly committed. But I think that is a sort of, it's a strange irony of the profession of lecturing.
Have any of your students shown up in a black bag?
I'm waiting for that. I'm waiting for that to happen. I've been invited to a reading where they've asked me if I'd be willing to dress as a black bag myself, which I don't know, because I think I would have trouble either seeing the book or turning the pages. I'm waiting for somebody to turn up to a lecture next week in full black leather oblong bag. That would please me greatly.
All right, well, let us know. Luke Kennard, his new novel, Black Bag. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences bestows its awards tomorrow. You probably just call them Oscars. That nickname for the ceremony and its gold-plated prizes became official in 1939. And as NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, no one really knows why.
Those iconic statuettes were originally called the Academy Award of Merit. So how did they get the name Oscar? Bruce Davis got that question all the time during his decades-long tenure as the Academy's executive director. And after his retirement in 2011...
I thought, okay, I'm going to find out why we call it the Oscar, and I'm going to write it down. As it turned out, that was not an easy thing to find out.
There were three main legends behind Oscar's nickname.
One of the things I realized early on was that each of them did have a flaw as a story. They could be debunked.
The term appeared in a 1934 gossip column. 2 years later, actress Betty Davis won her first statuette while she was married to a man with the middle name Oscar.
She said the hindquarters of the statuette were the very image of her husband.
But she later admitted she didn't coin the term. Some historians say a more likely source is Margaret Herrick, the Academy's librarian turned longtime executive director. Herrick said she compared the statue to her Uncle Oscar in the 1930s.
But because she couldn't show an Uncle Oscar, people were skeptical about it.
Bruce Davis believes the real originator was a different Academy staffer, a secretary named Eleanor Lilleberg. He found writings in her brother's archives that give her credit for the nickname, inspired by an Oscar from their childhood.
There was this veteran from the Norwegian army who was kind of a character in town and famous for standing straight and tall.
Davis acknowledges we may never know the full story, but he's just happy people still care about the Oscars, no matter who they're named after. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
The music of British singer James Blake seems to exist in two states at once, quiet and sincere, but with an undercurrent of bass, lush electronics. Then his commanding baritone that shifts into a falsetto that takes your breath away. He's on a 7th studio album, a couple of Grammys under his belt, and still wrestling with chaos.
I don't know how we got here. I think we might be sleeping. I think we might be walking to the death of love. It never seemed so hard to say what you really mean. Everything you have seen is from above.
James Blake joins us now from London. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We just heard a bit from The Death of Love. It's a haunting single.
Well, thank you.
You're saying it's never seemed so hard to say what you really mean. And it never seemed so hard to wake up from your dream. What puts you into the mood for this song?
Well, I mean, I started writing that song during the pandemic, like probably midway through it, at a time where I could feel people's empathy for each other kind of waning and potentially disappearing entirely under the weight of the chaos.
Yeah, I remember. And sometimes it just doesn't seem like some of that has really left us.
Yeah.
Let me ask about your technique, heavy bass and electronic music, and then your falsetto begins to dance. How do you play with your voice as an instrument in your music?
Well, as with all kind of art forms, the playing with the balance of light and dark, it's interesting you mentioned bass, because bass has a kind of sort of primal effect on us.
Yeah.
They say we interpret it as almost like a stampede. Mm-hmm. And it raises our arousal level in terms of, like, you know, excitement. And you can sort of employ sub bass to create excitement, but at the same time, there is something unsettling about it. So it can be used as a darker shade, where maybe some kind of pleasant falsetto could be the lighter shade, or maybe a positive lyric or something like that. I mean, you see that a lot in, like, reggae and dub.
How do you decide when to let your voice go full throttle and when to alter it electronically?
That comes down to how I am engaging with the lyric, probably. And there are times when I've maybe had enough of my own voice. You know, it happens. You'd be surprised to learn. But it is a nice trick when, you know, maybe my voice is across a long period of a song and then maybe there's no one else to sing with, so I'll just pitch my own voice up. Or there could be a section of a song, or even indeed a whole song, where it sounds closer to the truth of what I'm actually saying to pitch my voice up. I felt that in the case of Obsession, it felt like that.
How I need it, I wouldn't change it. How I want it, I wouldn't change it. How I need it.
I think music in general is word painting. So when I'm writing songs, the way I produce them is painting those songs. So sometimes one of the techniques, one of the brushstrokes, is to mess with the formant of the voice or kind of transform something that was otherwise organic into something that is less recognizable.
Let's hear more from the title track, Trying Times.
I'm breaking, I hide it well, 'cause I can't afford to replace the shell. I'm an eyesore, you're a sight for sore eyes.
That's quite a sequence. You moved back to London after a decade in L.A., right?
That's right, yeah. The record cover of me spinning many plates is a good encapsulation of my last couple years.
So you're doing a lot. Is that the plates in the air?
You know, I'm spinning many plates, but there's a poise to the way I'm stood, and I'm also, in a way, conducting. And so there was some element of functional poise within the chaos.
As we go through trying times.
And I guess in some way that's what we've all tried to maintain, you know, since the pandemic. It has felt like things are just slowly falling off a cliff, and it's quite, you know, I can see everyone trying their best to just keep things in place.
This is your seventh studio record. What do you learn as you go along?
Well, you know, part of an artist's journey is wrestling with, you know, how much do I need approval? Why am I doing this? What is the true reward of doing this? And I think those parameters shift over the course of your life and over the course of your career. And I'm lucky to have been around for a while now. And I can say that, you know, each album that goes by feels like I care less. You know, my value system becomes more aligned with my authentic self. And I think that is a hard journey to go on, but it is rewarding when you can say, okay, I made this thing and I genuinely love it, and I don't really care if, you know, it's not everyone's cup of tea. It sort of just is what it is. And that maybe is most true on this record. So that's surely a good thing regardless.
James Blake, his latest album, Trying Times, out now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker for people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. We've got a great day of programming ahead for you starting at 9 o'clock. It's the Oscar Breakdown with Andrew DeZingle, Heather Johnson, and Julie Crabb. 10 o'clock, Tom Daniel, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. And at noon, the history of recorded jazz with Paul Kivi. Coming up at 1:30, it's the Season Watch podcast. And at 4 o'clock, Darren White, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. That's followed at 7 o'clock by our ever-popular Green Cheese Trivia Show with Julie and Betsy Crabb. 9 o'clock, it's After Dark with Marie Debris. She'll be playing post-punk music. Today's weather, mostly sunny with highs in the low to mid-30s. Snow is possible this evening with lows 14 to 22. Chance of snow before noon tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs 18 to 26 with blustery north winds up to 35 miles per hour. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the teens, again that blustery north wind. You're listening to the Oscar Breakdown on KAXE.